Zhang Shu Bartholomew, and this is WEBR Fairfax Radio. On the Commons with me today is John McIlwain. Hi, John. You with us? You just got back from Boston, I understand. Hello?
There we go.
Oh, okay. Sorry, there was a switch I forgot to flip here. It's do-it-yourself radio. I think I screwed up. I put out the promo, and when I talked to you the other day, you said that it, I thought you said the J, as in J in Jason. But it's not. It's you're the chair of the J. Ronald Terwilliger.
Well, it's the position that I hold is senior resident fellow, the ULI J. Ronald Terwilliger Chair for Housing for the Urban Land Institute. It's really much simpler than that. It's just a senior fellow for housing at the Urban Land Institute.
Okay, but that's quite a mouthful.
It is.
Sounds very impressive.
Well, my job is to make the substance meet the style.
Okay. I'm sure you do it with absolutely no problems whatsoever. Hands tied behind your back.
Oh.
You know, we've been hearing so much about the Urban Land Institute. We read about it. There's references to the Urban Land Institute. ULI comes up all over the place. But I don't think any of us really understands exactly what happens at the Urban Land Institute. You want to give us a brief, overview of what happens?
Yeah, and I'd be delighted to. And it's actually a good time because this is an important period of time for real estate in general and the Urban Land Institute. It was formed back in the 1930s by some large-scale developers, and its mission is to provide responsible leadership in the use of land in order to improve the built environment. It's a membership organization, and it has about 17,000 members now in the United States and around the world. It does research on best practices in building cities, suburbs, housing, retail, offices, transportation. And the members are developers, some of the largest, most successful developers in the country, smaller developers, equally successful, but building smaller projects, and architects and urban planners and lawyers and all the people that my son used to accuse of being the land rapists. But the members at ULI really are the people in the development community who feel a sense of responsibility for doing it in accordance with the best practices that we know now.
The name suggests that you're only interested in urban areas, but that's not quite true, is it? You're sort of going into the suburbs and beyond.
Well, that is true, and that raises a very interesting question about what we mean by the city. We've always thought of there being a distinction between the city, being downtown like the District of Columbia, for our Washington area listeners, and the suburbs, Fairfax and Montgomery County. And that's been the conventional way in which cities in America have developed. But it's really changing now. It's changed thanks to the automobile, and I would say that the city really now is all of the above. It's really the whole urbanized area around us. It's a new city, and it has different parts to it. The Gaithersburgs, the Fairfaxes, the downtowns.
So what you're saying basically is that we're no longer the suburbs, we're part of Washington, D.C.
Yes, I think so, and I think the best description of who are the citizens of a city was by someone who said the citizens of a city like Washington are all the people who root for the Redskins.
For those
although
of you
that may be very few this year.
I was going to say, for those of you who don't know, that's our local football team, right?
Well, yes, it's our local losing football team, unfortunately, but it's had a great history. But it's any city. It's really the people who identify with the icons of that area, whether it's a sports team or whatever it is that really attracts people to that metropolitan area.
And Okay, so I guess so now we've kind of defined what you mean by urban. What about beyond the urban areas as you're defining them right now? What about, say, the countryside or?
Well, that's not an area that we've had as much focus on. It really does. Most of the built environment that we're focusing on is how do you build cities, the whole urban area. We do, as I was saying before, we do research, we do programs, educational programs. We run schools every year on how to build real estate. And we write articles, magazines, books. We have a whole list of publications on the best practices on everything from shopping centers, smart growth, reconfiguring suburbs, inner ring suburbs, all of the above. The rural areas are not an area that we have focused on as much, although I must admit to having a very personal interest in rural areas. I began my career in housing back in the early 1970s when my wife and I moved from New York up to Maine, and I became the deputy director of the Maine State Housing Authority, and ever since then we've either lived in Maine or spent as much of the summer or the year as we can in Maine and have gotten to know a very rural state really quite well.
Well, I think even just driving around, you suddenly see out in the middle of nowhere all these enormous subdivisions that are being created, and you wonder where all these people go to work or how they survive.
Well, they certainly spend a lot of time on the roads. And it's a pattern that started back in the 30s and then accelerated dramatically in the 40s and 50s. And it made a lot of sense at the time. People really did want to leave cities which were seen as dirty and smelly and disease-ridden and crime-ridden. And it was a great opportunity for people to move to fresh air and a backyard and trees. And it worked very, very well for 20, 30 years. What started to happen is that the population of the country has grown dramatically in the last 40, 50 years. And the amount of land that everyone is using has grown dramatically, even faster than the population. The number of cars have grown faster than the population. The size of houses has expanded from an average size and back around 1950 of 800, 900 square feet to somewhere around 2,000 square feet now per house on average. So we're using more and more resources, more and more land, more and more cars. And the result, of course, we see around us in most of our cities, which is the increasing congestion. Certainly Washington, we see it, where we stand second only to Los Angeles in our congestion. Atlanta, the congestion became so bad that they were in danger of losing all federal highway funds because the air pollution was so bad. So we're seeing it in lots and lots of the major cities in the country where the traffic is growing, the congestion is growing, air pollution is getting worse. And quite frankly, the quality of life that people sought in the suburbs is not what they're finding necessarily now.
Well, we're going to come back to that, but before we get to that, because that's something you and I talked about the other day when I invited you to come on the show. But I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the recent attack on our own Pentagon right here in Virginia, but also the World Trade Center in New York City. And I had asked you if we were going to start looking at building just a little bit differently, because as I sat there watching events unfold, I mean, I told you I'm not much of a one for being up in the middle of up near the top of the world. That's great for some people. I don't particularly like heights, so I'm much more comfortable down on terra firma. But I was watching that and thinking, we're building more and more. We're taking down all of the little old Arlington colonials around here that are 50 years old, and we're replacing them with these enormous towers. Is it a safety concern? Is it a safety issue? Are we putting people at risk by putting them up on the 60th, 70th, 80th, 90th floor Although I don't think we have anything quite that tall here. But
no, we don't have anything quite like they do in New York here in Washington, and I don't think we will. You've raised a number of very important questions that a lot of us are struggling with. I just returned from 4 days in Boston where ULI had its annual meeting. There were some 4,000 members from around the country and around the world who came. At first we thought after September 11th that maybe no one would come and we should cancel it, but then we realized that the kinds of questions, Shu, that you've just asked are on everyone's mind, and particularly on the minds of the development and real estate community. Where are we going? And it was a very touching, very important meeting, I think, for lots of us. People did show up. They did. For a lot of us, like myself, it was my first time back on an airplane, and it took a certain amount of fortitude to do that, although the experience turned out to be very, very easy, very peaceful, not a problem. So it was like getting back up on the horse. And we had a wonderful series of meetings. We had Daniel Patrick Moynihan talking about the rebuilding of New York and about the recent events, and he's a remarkable person to hear. And I think what I came away from with is the following thoughts. One is that I don't know that we're going to build the World Trade Center again as it is or as it was. I don't think we're going to build 110-story buildings. They aren't economic. They never have been economic. They were built more out of the sense of the architecture of ego rather than of economics.
Mm-hmm.
And there are very simple reasons for that. When you build a building that big, so much of it is taken up by the structure, so much of it is taken up by all the elevators that there isn't enough floor space to make it economic. And the trade centers never were economic. Now, that doesn't mean that we're not going to continue to build tall buildings. My guess is that we're going to build, we'll rebuild the trade center area. Part of it will be a memorial, no doubt, and a very moving one. But the rest of it will become offices, and if we're lucky, it will become a combination of offices, of apartments, and of retail, and a real much more human mix than occurred when the Trade Center was built. The Trade Center was really the last of the modernist architectural movement, and out of that were vast, empty plazas that really had very little to do with human scale. And I think we've learned now that, as people were talking about in Boston, that the key to a city is a street. It's the streetscape. It's where people interact. It's where life goes on.
Terra firma.
Yes, well, terra firma, exactly like you said. And we're learning now how to build environments that are human. And I would certainly hope that when the rebuilding goes on down there, that it will be grand, that it will be symbolic, that it will be economically important, but that also it will reflect the human scale. Now, let me just stop for a second and say that you said something at the start of this question that I really appreciated, and that was you started talking about the Pentagon
mm-hmm.
before you talked about the Trade Center. And
right.
I must say that nationally, the Pentagon almost has gotten lost.
Yeah, it has.
If New York had not happened, the attack on the Pentagon would have been seen as one of the worst acts
mm-hmm.
In history.
But if you look at the Pentagon, and if you go there, which I did, and you look at it, the damage that was done is minimal when you consider that you had an entire jetliner that crashed into it.
And well, certainly minimal compared to what was happening in New York. There's no question about that.
But I mean, if you look, the actual damaged area is quite small. People went back to work the next day. The damage did not even go through all the rings. It was sort of contained. And the entire building wasn't devastated. Not like two entire towers with entire companies that have been obliterated.
Well, you're making a very good point. I think a lot of people will think that way, but I think that, I have to say, if we're going to build cities, if we're going to live in cities, we are going to need to build up. Even in over here in the district where the building height limit is around 11 or 12 stories, the controlled height because of the Washington Monument,
mm-hmm.
which makes this a very European-style city. But if you, I believe that there will always be the Chicagos, the New Yorks, even the downtown Los Angeleses, the Atlantas, where we will have tall buildings. I don't think we'll have, as I said before, 110 stories. I don't know that we're going to have much more than 60 or 70 stories. And I think that, but I think that we'll have apartment buildings. I think we'll have areas like we do in Boston, which is a suburb of Washington, where we have 20-story apartment buildings. Because if we're going to have as many people as we have in this country, we now have 280 million people, and we're going to add in the next 10 years another 30 million people. So if we're going to be starting to add 30 million people or so every 10 years, which is certainly what is the likely projection at this point, we need to live together. And I would say most people want to live together. They may not want to live, all of us, in apartment buildings. But there's something about the vibrancy of a city. There's something about the interaction that goes on in a city that is creative. It supports business, it supports culture, it supports the economy. And cities are going to continue to be the primary economic generators around the world, and they're also going to be the primary cultural and social generators around the world, and people want to be part of that.
You're talking about the city. I always call it a palpable energy. I mean, when I'm out in the country or in a small town someplace, it just, you just sort of kick back and things slow down. I think my entire being slows way down. But when I go downtown, not so much in the suburbs, but when I go into Washington, it's sort of enervated. You know, there's this energy that you can feel. It's almost like you could see it just intertwining around the place. But you can get that without piling people on top of each other, can't you, or can you?
Well, you need a certain density. You need a certain interactivity. You need a certain friction, a certain people rubbing up against each other. And that just seems to be the way we're built. You know, we've been building cities for 4,000 or 5,000 years. This is not a new phenomenon. The only reason we're building so much taller now is because we have the technology to do that. When we started to invent back around the end of the last century, the steel frame buildings, and then we've invented the elevator. Since then, we've been adding to the density as our populations have increased, and I think that that's going to continue. I think that there's always going to be some risk, but the way in which buildings are designed today is remarkably risk-free compared to 100 years ago. The terrible thing that happened to the World Trade Center towers needs to be kept in context, because first off, the attack was by planes that were far larger than was ever envisioned. Second, no one had envisioned they would be filled with jet fuel as in an intentional attack.
Mm-hmm.
And even so, the building stood for over an hour, which let thousands and thousands of people get out safely. Now, I know thousands of people tragically were not able to, but you've got to remember that far more people did get out alive, and it was because of that, even though those buildings ultimately collapsed, they actually withstood an amazing attack. And what we're hearing from engineers and architects is that while you can never build a building to withstand that kind of attack, the safety features of buildings today are far better than, frankly, the little wood frame house that we have up in Maine now that we go up to during the summer. It's a little tiny wood frame house. It's only two stories. But people die in those buildings, too, when they catch fire and you're asleep and you don't have your smoke mm-hmm. detectors or things like that. The world is it's an uncertain place, unfortunately.
Going back to technology and the way things are built, I don't know when the World Trade Center was built, and I don't know exactly when the Pentagon was built, but and I'm not sure if the damage done, if the difference between the damage done to both buildings was because of their relative height, or because of the different construction methods. I mean,
I think that's a good question. I'm not an engineer, but I can say a couple of things. One is the Pentagon was built I think just before or during World War II.
Right.
And the Trade Center was built, finished about 25 years ago, 1975. And they are dramatically different. Not only their form is dramatically different, but the types of construction is dramatically different. Yeah, I think that to a certain extent, the Pentagon, to a large extent, the Pentagon's a much different target, much harder to hit target, and than the Trade Center will ever be. Although the Pentagon,
because of its height,
and I think to a certain extent because it was low, it didn't have, it had a lot more concrete in it than you could put into a building as big as the Trade Center buildings. So I think height does have a big difference, but there's a the Pentagon, I don't know how many stories it goes up. I think only five or six stories
high.
Yeah,
it's not a very tall building.
And I don't expect, frankly, that we will all be living in buildings that aren't over five or six stories. I just think you're going to find that people are going to be wanting to live in downtown areas. And by downtown areas, I no longer just mean like downtown Washington or...
You're talking about the suburbs as well. You're just pulling everything in together.
Yeah, you can have areas of... you can have new downtowns in areas around cities. We're seeing it all over the place. In Atlanta, for example, out in Buckhead, is becoming a downtown with residential and offices and retail there. Not a very well-designed one, but it could be designed very well. And if you look around cities around the country, there are areas outside in what are the suburbs. Joel Garreau wrote a book called Edge Cities.
Mm-hmm.
And these are, in effect, edge cities. These edge cities are becoming cities, although I would say they're not necessarily on the edge. They're generally well within the whole urban environment. And there are nodes of density, and if we're smart, we can build them in ways that actually make them into vibrant little downtowns, small cities in and of themselves.
And that's basically all under the umbrella of what's being called new urbanism.
It's new urbanism, it's smart growth, it's the it's a combination of those two. That's exactly right.
And if we, and I don't know about the other cities, but I know what's happening, say, in Fairfax County, and we talked about this the other day when I called you. Areas around metro stations are, you know, the little old brick houses that have been there for 40, 50 years are being demolished and they're being replaced by towers, with the idea that people can just walk and get on a bus or, you know, basically slide down the banister from the 67th floor and right into the train and on into...
wear their slippers to work.
Yeah, actually. But aren't we increasing congestion by doing that? Because now we've taken an area where you may have had, I don't know, 10, 20, 200 small houses and replaced it with a massive structure, or several massive structures, that houses tens and hundreds more people than used to live there. I mean, aren't we increasing the congestion and the density and the number of people that are sort of being crammed onto the same small area?
We are. There's no question that we're doing that. But look at the alternative and look at what we're really doing here. Our population in this country is not static. We have a population that's almost double what it was in 1950.
Where are they coming from?
Well, they're coming from families that are having kids, if you must know. Now, we did have the largest influx of immigrants in the last 10 years in this country's history. More people came from other countries to America in the 1990s than ever in our history before, even back in around 1900 when we had our first big wave of immigration. And, of course, that's how we've all gotten here. We're all, with the exception of our Native American brothers and sisters, who actually did immigrate also, apparently, but maybe a couple of thousand years ago, we're all the sons and daughters of immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a question of how many generations we've been here. So immigration is as American as apple pie. And we had a large influx of people, and I think that's going to continue as long as we remain the wealthiest and most stable nation on Earth, which we certainly are now. People are just always, the people with energy and drive are always going to want to come here. And even, however, if we were for some terrible reason to shut down all immigration, we have such a youthful population that we might not have 30 million people, but we'll still have 25 million people more in 10 years. It's mostly going to be internal growth that's already in the country. And it's something that we just have to accommodate. We have to build in the next 10 years enough homes to be the equivalent of four New York cities.
I think you were saying something like 18, or I was reading somewhere, 18 million.
That's right.
New units.
18 million new units in the next 10 years, and that's four New York cities. And,
wow.
And yes, exactly. So it's not a small task. This is not the same situation we had back in 1950.
Are we going to put these 18 million new homes? And this is 18 million new homes or 18 million new people? 18 million new homes.
New homes, buildings, units.
Where are we going to put them? All within urban areas?
Well, that's the question. If we spread them out around the country, people are going to wind up having to do a lot of driving to get to their jobs. And that's going to really add to the congestion.
But wait a minute, John. I mean, we've got telecommuting's now a big thing. with all technology that we've got, I mean, you can even have one radiologist work for three or four different hospitals in different states from his or her home with the technology that's available today.
And are we doing that?
Yes.
A little bit.
We are, but I mean, it's not quite so desperately necessary anymore. We've got the technology.
But now, shoo, let's go back to what we were talking about before, about the sense of energy of a city.
But not everybody likes that energy. I do, but not everybody does.
And I'm not suggesting everybody will, but I will suggest that the large majority of people are not going to want to spend 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in their little home out in the country talking to people through computers. It's just not a lot of fun. I spend all my life on computers, and if I didn't have people around me, I'd shoot myself.
Yeah, I kind of tend to agree with you on that, but believe it or not, some people kind of enjoy that. Listen, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Don't go away.
I bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.
WBR Fairfax Radio, you're on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew. On the Commons with me is John McKilwin from ULI, and that was One Way Ticket to Hell. Can't seem to stop playing that. Everybody keeps requesting it. John, that was a song that was written for us by someone who, a professional musician, who was having problems with his condominium board, so he wrote this thing. And everybody absolutely loves it. It's not available commercially yet, so until it is, I play it at the bottom of the hour. So that's kind of fun. Just got one quick announcement for those of you who are into progressive rock. This Sunday, Paul Sears is going to be joining Debbie Bradshaw at 8, Sunday at 8, if you're interested in that. And Paul Sears apparently is from the group The Muffins. So be sure to tune in and catch that if you like. There's so much to talk about, John. This is incredible. I've really been looking forward to doing this show, so I'm really thrilled to have you with me. I noticed on, I went to the to ULI's website, and that's when I realized that I'd screwed up on the name of your chair, which is J. Ronald Terwilliger instead of J. and Ronald Terwilliger. Unfortunately, I put that on there. But I noticed that you're also in sort of take care of affordable housing. And I kind of wanted to go there just a wee bit, if we could.
Sure. The area that we're focusing on now on the issue of affordable housing, you know, there's been a lot of focus over the years on housing for low-income people, people who are on welfare or people at part-time jobs or people who are working full-time but are still below the poverty level. And it's a very important area of focus. And that's where most of the public housing programs have focused to try to provide housing for that population. And we certainly haven't finished that job by any means. The housing affordability for people at the poverty level or below is still very, very difficult. But one of the things that we've started to see in this country in the last 10 years is a dramatic rise in the difficulty that working families are having in either rent, finding an apartment to rent or a house to buy that they can afford. Now, that the standard test for affordability for folks is if you're going to rent, to pay no more than 25% of your income for rent. Now, that the standard, the federal test is 30%, but I think a more realistic one is 25%. Or if you're going to buy a home, the standard that's generally used both by banks and by the government and others is that you shouldn't pay more than 30% of your income for housing. If you use those standards, more and more Americans are finding that they can't find a decent home either to rent or to buy and meet those affordability standards, that they're having to pay much more than that in order to rent an apartment or buy a home. And that's been getting worse. It's been getting worse particularly in the last 10 years for the group of people who are between 50% of median income and 100-120% of median income. Now, who are those people? They tend to be teachers, nurses, policemen, firemen, municipal workers. And these are folks working, if it's a married couple or if it's a couple, it's probably they're both working. And in city after city around the country, they're finding fewer and fewer apartments or houses that they can rent or buy that they can afford. And they're having to spend more, either one of two things, more and more of their money for housing, or they're having to move further and further away from where their jobs are. The other way we look at that is so many communities around the country are looking for more teachers. The competition for new teachers is very hard. One of the reasons why for so many communities it's hard to find teachers, other than that there's a shortage of teachers, but once you find a teacher you want, more often than not, the teacher can't afford to buy a home in that community or to rent an apartment in that community. They have to live outside, farther and farther away, and then drive. So it adds to the time that they have to spend working. The commuting time is added on. The congestion is added on. And, again, the air pollution quality is something that we're all beginning to notice. Where we're building our most affordable housing is in the outer fringes of our urban areas. And where the jobs are all over the urban area and in the downtowns and in the various inner suburbs or older suburban areas. But we're not building housing there that many of our families can afford.
How do you assure a steady supply of affordable housing? I mean, if a house, say you had two houses that were built, one was built as affordable housing, and let's say I bought it and 3 years later decided it was time to move, and this was sitting next to a house that was not affordable. You know, for a comparison, if you're looking at real estate, comparatively speaking, then my house, I would have made a ton of money on that and would be able to then sell my house and move on to someplace else, and then that affordable unit would be gone.
Well, that's right, and people have different views on how to handle that. My own view is that one of the things that Americans have all benefited from, Americans who've been able to buy a home have benefited from, has been the rise in housing values, and it's been the largest single source of wealth for American families for decades and decades. And so someone who buys a home in an affordable program ought to have that same benefit. There are other programs. People look at it sometimes differently, and they say, well, you can only do that if you stay in that home for, say, 5 or 6 years. Or they say, well, you can, we'll share the benefit. Some of that money you have to pay back, so it goes back into a program for the next family to build another home that's affordable, and you get some of the benefit. So it varies, and I think the ultimate answer is always going to be that we have to continue to build enough homes.
So we're just going to continually build more affordable homes.
As long as we're going to continue to have families whose incomes are at modest levels. One of the things that's happened is while overall incomes in this country have risen over the last 10 years, most of that rise, almost all of that rise, have been in the incomes of people in the top fifth of the population. People who are at the middle levels have not seen their incomes rise, particularly adjusted for inflation. On the other hand, the cost of housing has increased. So as long as we're going to have that kind of separation in incomes and costs, we need to have programs run by local governments, run by state governments, employers, employer-assisted housing, all of these kinds of programs that are going to help to close that gap.
I've got an article here from New Jersey, and apparently they have caps. You cannot, you know, once a house has been designated as affordable housing, it will never, ever go up. One of them was sold at a sheriff's sale, and the person who bought it for $41,000, thinking they could sell it and get $80,000 in profit after they'd fixed it up, found out that they couldn't. It ended up costing them something like $17,000, and they had to give it back because the cap, there was a cap placed on mm-hmm. this house, and nothing was going to move. But let's say that the house had not gone to foreclosure. Let's say that the people who had bought it were able to keep it. But then if you've got 30 years where they can't sell it, they can't make a profit, aren't they stuck, basically?
I think they are. I think that's exactly right. I think they're stuck. I think they're seeing all their neighbors benefit from the rising values in that community. I think they no longer really care about that home. They no longer think of it as a long-term investment. They aren't interested in maintaining it. They aren't as interested in what goes on in that neighborhood and caring for that neighborhood. I think they lose a lot of the real benefits of home ownership, not just the economic benefits, but the psychic benefits of knowing that you have a real stake in that community.
You might as well rent. I mean, you're walking away with nothing, basically.
Well, in some ways, you have the worst of both worlds, because when you rent, at least there's a landlord who is responsible for fixing the sink when it breaks. Here, you have to do that, and you don't get any benefit from the extra hard work.
I mean, I don't mind. I think we should look at making sure that housing is affordable. But I think that sometimes we come up with some really strange ideas, and ultimately it's just sort of harmful. But the show is about, you know, we've only got about 15 minutes left in the show, but the show basically is about homeowner associations. And I went to ULI's website, and I found out that I found something here. It says in 1960s, ULI pioneered the concept of open space communities, which became identified as planned unit developments. From ULI's standpoint, what was the idea for the planned community? Was it the governance aspect of it, or was it mostly the design aspect?
I think it was a combination of the two. Clearly, if you're going to... the planned unit development back then was, to the developers of the day, what smart growth is today. It's the most forward-thinking way of organizing a new subdivision. The old Levittown model which worked at first, was you put a house every few feet along the streets, and you build out the entire place with little lots and little houses. And that was a great breakthrough, very successful. But then people started to think, well, look, if we start to cluster the houses and we have common open, we can have bigger areas of open space that everyone can take advantage of. And out of that also, then people said, well, gosh, that's common open space. Who's going to take care of it? And then somebody very brilliantly said, well, look, why don't you have everybody get together and share that responsibility? And they can also share the responsibility for the roads and whatever other common amenities, a pool or whatever, the tennis courts as well. So it was a way of helping communities to work together. Now, the concept has grown dramatically over the years and has taken many, many forms. It's taken the form of high-rise condominiums. I know you don't want to live in the top floor of one of those condominiums, Shu, but there
are people
who... Oh,
that's just a personal preference. That's, I have nothing... I really don't.
I know that, but I'm just kidding. But there are people who love those. We have the good fortune of being at the top floor of our small little apartment building, although it's only four stories high. And so there are condominium associations to manage those buildings. It's a way of breaking up the ownership and giving people the ability to live in apartments but own them. There are the planned unit associations. They take on many, many forms. And it's a form that has had wonderful benefits and also, very frankly, has also taken on something of, occasionally, from time to time, takes on something of a negative spin, too. When people form private homeowner associations as a way of keeping out other types of people, keeping the place looking just like themselves, people do have a natural tendency to want to live by themselves or live with others who are like them, and they have to a certain extent, they have a right, as long as they also aren't segregating illegally. There's a, you know, everybody in this country has an equal right to own a home and to live in communities. And sometimes, very frankly, the homeowners associations have started to evolve into ways to control who moves into our communities.
Well, it's not only who moves into it, but, you know, they control everything from, you know, the height, the type of plants you plant in your front yard.
The color of paint.
The color of paint, the curtains you have. And some of them, they even regulate the way you dress in condominiums. They don't want people in shorts or slippers or hair rollers. Or
the age of people. You can't have kids in there in some cases. Yeah, it can get very. This is a big tension for a lot of folks.
That's why I'm here, John, because a lot of people really have a whole lot of problems with their associations. However, I see that it's a $35 billion annual industry, and it's probably not going to go away.
No.
But since ULI is doing the research, I have an idea for you.
Cool,
is there any way, we can still design them physically the way we're designing them, but is there any way to separate out the common property from privately owned property? I just have a real problem with using somebody's home as collateral to make a swimming pool run. Can we not give the swimming pool or sell the land or donate the land or however you want to do it to a private company and really privatize this whole thing? Give it to Off the Deep End or Pools R Us or whatever you want to call it and let them manage the pool. And they can make the decisions. And then if they make the bad economic financial decisions, they're the ones who are on the hook for it, not some poor guy who's been paying for this for years and not really benefited by it, never uses it, and then is at risk of losing his home because he can't come up with the special assessments to cover the cost of fixing the pool.
Shu, there's absolutely no reason why that can't be done. In fact, every homeowners association in America today could switch to that form if they wanted to. It would take a little bit of work, but if people want to do that, it makes complete sense. What you said makes complete sense, and it's certainly very doable. In fact, it's not even that big a shift because most homeowner associations are actually managed by private companies. So the pool is already being managed by a private company.
Yeah, but private property then is being held, used as collateral, basically, because if the pool fails...
That's right. No, so the shift is not so much on the management side, but the shift is on the ownership side and the economic side.
So you'd still basically have the amenities. You'd still have all of the things you want to have. You can have your downtowns and your shops and your movie theaters and, you know, but just... truly privatize it, sell it to a company that does that and is going to profit by it, and then just leave the private homes separate.
I think one reason, however, Shu, why communities are sometimes reluctant to do that is because when you turn it over to that private company, you have to let that private company run it the way it wants to if
That's
it owns
right.
it, and it's got to make a profit. If it's taking the economic risk of loss, it has to be able to set the fees however it wants to.
That's right.
In fact, it may even have to have the right to bring in people from outside the community to use the pool as well.
That's right.
And so most homeowners associations say, well, now, wait a minute. We don't want these people to get out of hand. We don't want them to... What if it turns out that they're a bad management company? What if it turns out that they're going to let in all of these strangers into using our pool? What if they're going to raise the rates beyond what we think is reasonable?
See, they're now in a position where they're forced to make sound fiscal judgments because they're going to have to make it economically feasible and viable instead of saying, oh, well, we can always raise assessments to cover our losses,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't really matter. And that's what's happening right now. Yes, if they want to raise the rates beyond what people want to pay for them, then they're going to close down. They're going to lose the business. But they're the ones that are taking the risks. They're the ones that are going to have to start looking at running these recreational facilities through an entirely different, with a different idea of how to run it. There's going to be a whole new thinking. You're going to let the marketplace dictate whether that guy stays in business or not. Not risk private property to keep
the
pool open.
It's very interesting what you're saying, because what you're saying, I think, at heart is that people, on the one hand, are taking an economic risk, and they would be willing to give up the risk and give up control. In order to get less risk, they'll take less control.
Listen, nobody has control right now.
Well,
nobody has control right now. I mean, let's be honest with each other. You know as well as I do, there is no control. I mean, it's just thrown in there. You get a new board today, a new board tomorrow. It turns over from one company to another company
company. Don't be quite that cynical, because you can, with a certain amount of energy, get your neighbors together and get on the board and have an impact. It's frequently difficult, but so is democracy. Is always difficult.
But I'm not saying that. I mean, I realize, and I've done it. But then, don't you realize that the people that have been unseated, who may not have done anything wrong, really,
right?
It's just that they had a different idea,
right?
Or they had a different opinion, or they had a different. They stood to gain something. I mean, maybe they had. I don't know, whatever reason. But what you've done is you've created different levels of membership, or different levels of neighbors, basically. And you've basically, from what I've seen, and that's what I deal with as a rule, is we've polarized an entire community. Just turn it over. If you want to buy the pool and you want to operate the pool and you want to set the rates, then, hey, good luck to you. It's like going down to the local mall and walking into the local shop. If you don't like the shop, you don't go into the shop. It's that simple.
Well, that's one of the reasons why, when friends of mine tell me that they're thinking of buying an apartment in a condominium association, it's a conversation I had very recently, I say, get to know, read the bylaws, talk to people about it. In fact, we stayed away from a building when we were moving into Washington. I won't tell you the name of it. But it was because the whole direction of that condominium association was not to take care of the building, not to bring in enough reserves, not to invest, and I could see a huge fight coming down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided, I think we'll go buy someplace else.
Yeah. No, and that's smart, and you knew what you were doing. A lot of people don't, especially when they're at the lower end of the of the economic scale, and they're only limited to very small things. So the choice then becomes, do we buy or do we just, you know, get a tent someplace and maybe move under the 14th Street Bridge?
Well, I think it's the issue of at what point are you economically ready to become a homeowner, whether you're going to join an association or buy your own home, is a very important point. And actually, in the issue in the area of affordable housing, it's becoming a bigger question, because there are more and more mortgage programs to let people buy homes with no down payment.
Yeah.
And that puts them more and more at risk.
Well, I think also one tends to sort of think that affordable housing has got to be part of a homeowners association, and the developments that were built that I'm aware of, that were built specifically as low-income housing, they're having all kinds of problems. They can't afford to put money aside to rebuild roads and streets and things like that. And so I question whether that portion of it is really affordable. But
I agree with you.
Okay, so good. We're on the same wavelength there. But beyond that, is there any way that you and I could maybe come up with some different plan where you can separate out the private property away from all of this, still develop it the way you want to, you can still increase density, you know, and there's all sorts of ways of doing it. You've got zigzag lot lines, zero lot lines, and all of that, and you can still have the shops that would be privately owned, and you can still have the recreational amenities that would also be privately owned.
Well, I will tell you that after this conversation, I'm going to be giving that considerable thought.
Oh, good. Maybe you'll come back sometime and talk to us about that.
I would be delighted.
Listen, John, I really appreciate you coming. I appreciate it because I know you just got home late last night.
Well, it's been a real pleasure doing this. I enjoy the conversation. It's fun talking with you, Shu, and I hope it's been interesting for your listeners.
I'm sure it has been. I'm sure that I'm going to be hearing a lot from them.
Well, if they have suggestions or ideas, don't hesitate to either send them over to me directly or have them email them or call them into me directly.
Sounds great. All right. Well, they can, you know, if you want to get in touch with John, you can always email me at onthecommons@cox.rr.com, and I'll be more than happy to put you in touch with them. If I come up with any more brilliant ideas, I'll give you a call, John. But I do hope you'll come back and join me sometimes.
I'd be delighted to.
Right here on the Commons. Thanks. Thanks again. And thanks for being with us today. Stay tuned, because at 4, it's Night Train with Squire, and then at 6, it's Doug Goffis with the Goffis Rock Experience. But up next, it's Mara Smith with Mold Show. See you all here, right here on WBR next.